you don't have any people in these stories. And they said, well, they're about machines. They said, no, they're about the people that built them. And that's who we want to get to know.
News, science, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Graylian bunker, welcome one and all. I am Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. Glad as always to be able to be in the pocket with you as we are looking out into space, time, and the cosmos at the mysteries of our existence. Tonight, we've got a lot to cover as always, but on that subject of space, later in the program, very special guest joining us for hour two, Rod Pyle. That's right, he is an expert not only on space, but also the robots that we have sent out there into interstellar space and what they are beaming back to us here on Terra Firma and teaching us about the cosmos. So Rod will be joining us to talk about his latest book and the robots we are sending out into space. Really excited to talk with him about that. I also want to talk about, in terms of biology, now Adam sent me a wonderful story, as he always does, but are bad omens that are associated with the appearances of certain animals, is that more mythology or is there some fact to it? We'll get into a little of that, and also just what's been going on in the news, and also in my ongoing search for odd things in American newspapers, combing the Library of Congress archives, I found some great additions to the classic mystery that was occurring over Scandinavia right after the Second World War. Those, of course, are the so-called ghost rockets. Yeah, I found some really interesting reports on that, and I think we will feature a little discussion about that later on, too. So anyway, how are you? Hope everybody is doing good. I hope everyone has been staying warm the last few days. This has been no joke. And of course, we let off last week talking about the weather, but there's an old adage that goes that people without weather wouldn't normally have anything to talk about. You're standing in line at the post office. How are you? Well, I'm doing good. Man, how about this weather? In other words, it's a sure sign if you're talking about the weather, you've got nothing else to talk about. We've got plenty else to discuss. So if on this program we've been mentioning the weather, it's for one of two reasons. There's something freakish going on, like what's happened over the last few days. Or two, I'm concerned about it, and I want to make sure people stay warm. And so, of course, it's always disconcerting when you're reading in the news about people who did not heed these warnings, people trying to find shortcuts home in the cold, get off the beaten path, stay out too long, and with a wind chill factor of negative 60 or lower, you're dang right people were affected by it. So anyway, my heart goes out to those who've been affected by the cold. It's 62 degrees in Asheville today, where I am. Yeah, unseasonably warm. But again, this time of the year, usually what happens when it's that warm is that it usually means some cooler weather is on the way. I don't know if that's going to be the case this week. Let's hope not. I've seen enough snow for one year. Although I think we had some news on the groundhog front the other day. That's right. Yes, Groundhog Day. You know, when I say that, and I bet you a lot of folks out there, they don't think about the holiday. They think about the Bill Murray film, right? I know I do. I mean, it's a great film. It's one of my favorite Bill Murray movies. So anyway, Groundhog Day. Supposedly, Punxsutawney Phil did not see his shadow, despite the cold, despite it being a clear day here on Groundhog Day. That's right. So he's not predicting six more weeks of winter. He's predicting an early spring. And if the weather here in the Appalachian Mountains is any indication, maybe the cold snap we saw last week is behind us. Let's hope so anyway, right? The other thing that was going on over the last few days, let's see, cold weather, Groundhog Day, and yes, that big game, I can't actually say the word. Remember, it's copywritten. You get in trouble if you say it, if you're not authorized to be able to talk about it. So we'll play it safe and call it the big game. Did you guys watch it last night? More importantly, while the game was on, were you enjoying merriment and festivities, fine foods, and perhaps watching what was going on Twitter? You know, it's funny because when there are two kinds of events, I'm often paying more attention to Twitter than I am what's on television. And that's during the super, can't say it. Sorry, the big game. So it's during the big game and it's during live televised presidential debates in election years. And when those two things are on television, and as you guys know, I have been stoic for the last decade about my attitudes toward television. I have a Netflix account and I will stream certain things on TV. If there's a new show that I really want to watch, like Project Blue Book, I will buy a season pass and stream that on television too, especially if I want to show support for a certain show. But yeah, I do not own a TV. I haven't for years. I'll probably break down eventually and get one again. And so even with the Super Bowl, yeah, I'm streaming that online. I'm watching it. Well, I was kind of watching it again. I was paying attention to Twitter because I was almost more interested in seeing what my friends who are sports fans, who really keep up with stuff like this, because I don't, admittedly, I can see what they have to say and remain in the know. But I do watch the big game. And of course, I'm keeping tabs on what's going on Twitter. And Nicole, my pal up in Ohio, the Buckeye Biz, she's a big sports fan. And so I can watch her Twitter and see what she's saying. And she, like many, I think, were watching the game last night. And it was 3-0. For how long? I mean, my gosh, most of the duration of the game. Right there at the end, it ended up being a lot more entertaining. But for the longest time, we were just kind of watching not a whole lot of anything. Again, it ended up getting more exciting toward the end. But a lot of people don't even watch the big game for the actual football, for the game itself. No, they've made this into this kind of a multi-entertainment industry where as many people probably tune in to watch either the halftime show, more on that in a moment, or they are watching the commercials. And I was reading all this commentary about the commercials this year. And some of the things that commentators were talking about was the fact that, well, the commercials played it safe this year. They avoided politics and they had a lot of celebrities. Yeah, I think that was a fair assessment. We dropped a new Avengers trailer. Harrison Ford made a cameo. A lot of people made cameos. There were some decent commercials. And then there was that weird Burger King commercial, the Andy Warhol Burger King commercial. And my pal Shira Lazar, I've actually never met her. We follow each other on Twitter. So in this day and age, you know, if you follow each other on Twitter and interact from time to time, you can say that you're sort of pals, right? But some of you guys would know Shira Lazar as a Los Angeles-based comedian. She's also a commentator on various programming. In fact, right here in Asheville, North Carolina, often when you're stopping and getting gas at those gas stations where they have the little video screen, which in my theory about that, of course, you're pumping gas and then they'll play sports or headlines and you start paying attention to what's on television and then you don't realize that you're still pumping gas, right? And you're more likely to buy more gas. Brilliant scheme, right? That's right. Watch TV while you're pumping gas, you'll pump more gas. But one day I was standing there and lo and behold, the screen pops up and they have this entertainment news segment and there's this young woman on the screen and she says, "Hi, I'm Shira Lazar." And I'm like, wait a minute, she follows me on Twitter. So that was kind of surprising, and some of you guys may know her that way too. But anyway, Shira Lazar, comedian, LA-based entertainer, and she's tweeting about this. And of course, this is probably what she and I have in common too. She's talking about the robots, and she's joking about Tom Brady being part of the Illuminati, you know, just making jokes. But one of the things that she was joking about on Twitter had been the robot element, and how in the future we're going to see more and more robots involved with the big game and the programming of it. I mean, I actually tell you the truth, I'm sure a lot of you guys are already paying attention to the way that drones are being used and have been for years. But, I mean, a lot of the action that's going on the field, a lot of the overhead shots, back in the day they would actually have a person maybe on a crane and they're actually operating a camera up there. Now they send a little drone, I mean, smaller than an actual football. And in some of the screenshots, you can actually see the drone following the ball players. I mean, they can do unprecedented photography now with drones, and I wonder what it's like playing football, where they're actually out there on the field, and for obvious reasons, they can't have the drones out there just in the middle of the game. They might actually get in the way. And so usually it's over off to the side that you're going to get those kind of aerial shots, but you can actually see in some of the shots the drones following the ball players. I was amazed. So yeah, there is this element where technology is really changing the way that we consume media like this and the way that we perceive sports from the field, so to speak. And so like we're going to be doing with Rod Pyle in the second hour, talking about robots and the way that they're changing reality as we know it. Shira was talking about a lot of that on Twitter last night. And I tweeted back at her and I said, yeah, and who knows, you know, next year, the entire halftime show might actually be performed by robots. And then I had to add a quick addenda. Oh, actually, that happened this year. Oh, echo. That wasn't even just reverb. Man, I tell you, the technology, like I said, folks. But no, all kidding aside, I mean, a lot of people were just like, you know, there have been some great halftime shows in the past. And, you know, Maroon 5, they're really talented, but that just was not a hugely popular halftime show based on everything I was seeing on Twitter or anywhere else today. Everybody reporting on the big game, they're saying, hey, you know, like the last 15 minutes of the game really is what saved it for everybody. And a few of the commercials were okay. But apart from that, it wasn't really a very memorable game. I don't know. maybe you guys would disagree, maybe it was the most thrilling experience you've ever had. About halfway through, I was working on other things and had the game on in the background and was texting to Jeremy London, who was doing the same. Because for those of us in the working world, there's another name for Sunday night, and it's called pre-Monday. I'm sure some of you guys probably know what I'm talking about. Yeah, Sunday night is the night where after a nice day of rest and relaxation, you start to look ahead at all the stuff you've got to do the next day, all the fires you'll be putting out on Monday morning. So yeah, that's what a lot of us were doing during the game last night, apart from tweeting and thinking about robots and the future of humanity. Who knows, maybe Shira would actually come on the podcast at some point and talk with us about that. Now, why would I have her on to talk about robots instead of an artificial intelligence expert, for instance? Well, I've interviewed a lot of AI experts, including Dr. Benjamin Gertzel. I've had him on this show twice, in fact, in the past, and he was recently on Joe Rogan for the first time the other day, and they say that they're going to have him back on frequently for updates. I'm hoping so, because whether it's robots we send out into space, like Rod Pyle's going to tell us about, whether it's artificial intelligence like Benjamin Gertzel and others talk about, or whether it is the perspective of a comedian. And I find comedians to be very important and unique people in our society. Here's why. Because as society, in this current day and age, where everything is so sensitive and people are so easily rubbed the wrong way and their feathers become so easily ruffled, you know, I saw an article, I believe it was at Wired the other day, and they were asking, you know, in this day and age where everybody is offended by everything, what does that do to comedy? But for me, if you look at like George Carlin and some of the great comedians of our day, they are some of the most intelligent and, frankly, I think some of the most important commentators on current events. And so whether it's robots or whether it's philosophy, whether it's politics, whether it's the world, you know, science, I actually like the opinions of comedians because they can, by virtue of being comedians, they can say things that others can't get away with. Well, they used to be able to. I don't know that they can anymore. That seems to be what's changing. I worry about the idea that comedy, once a form of protected speech and one that everyone enjoyed because they knew it was meant to be tongue-in-cheek, now people are offended even by comedians who are making fun of things and obviously being tongue-in-cheek or in character. So I don't know, maybe Shira would be the perfect person to come on and talk about robots. You know, I respect the opinions of comedians for all those reasons, and frankly, also because many of them are in their own right philosophers. Again, George Carlin, he certainly was one of those guys. So anyway, I think we have successfully completed our canvassing of media events and other things of the last several days. So let us turn our attention now to news and see what's going on out there. You know, speaking of robots in space, there's some news about China's Chang'e 4 rover, which landed on the far side of the moon last month. I'm sure we'll touch on that with Rod in the next hour. But we had these chilly temperatures down here on Earth, and interestingly, a similar phenomenon was occurring on the moon. And so this, well, we'll get into that in a moment. Astronomy.com was reporting on this, okay, because the rover recently woke up after a chilly night and has basically done some science and gone back to sleep. And here's what they said. They said that the Chinese lunar mission is returning data again after a scheduled 2-week rest period. Hey, the little guy had to take some time off. I mean, it takes a lot to get up there. Once you successfully make it to the moon, broadcast pictures back, yeah, take some time off, right? I know I would. Actually, no, I probably wouldn't. Knowing me, I'd be so excited because I was on the moon, I would go straight to work and just keep working until I finally passed out. And my body said, no, you now lay down or else, right? So anyway, now the actual rover is not the Chang'e 4. That's the name of the lunar mission, basically. But the rover is called the U-2-2, all right? It woke up on January 29th, but the lander slept in an extra day, they say. The rest mode, they believe, was necessary due to those frigid nighttime temperatures on the far side of the moon. And we thought it was cold here in North America with a wind chill of 60 or 70 below. Try this one on for size. Negative 310 degrees Fahrenheit. That was the actual temperature, not the wind chill. Presumably, I guess there isn't really wind on the moon, right? But you're definitely going to get some extreme cold while you're up there, especially if you're on the dark side where you're not getting some of that warm sunlight that you need. So they said, according to the measurements of the Chang'e 4, the temperature of the shallow layer of the lunar soil on the far side of the moon is lower than the data obtained by the U.S. Apollo mission on the near side of the moon. Maybe not too surprising, right? That's probably, they say, due to the difference in lunar soil composition between the two sides of the moon. And they report we still need more careful analysis. And that specifically was reported by Zhang He, the executive director of the Chang'e 4 probe project. But I want to touch on the difference in soil composition on the different sides of the moon for a moment. Probably a lot of people that wouldn't mean anything to them. If I'm interpreting this correctly, though, the fact that on the nearer side of the moon, where Apollo took samples before, and where we now have samples that are being analyzed on the moon on the far side, one reason for a difference in the composition could have to do with the fact that the far side of the moon actually receives more radiation. And the reason we see the same side of the moon at all times, the so-called face of the moon, is because of tidal forces. And I don't want to go way down that rabbit hole, but in essence, I mean, that this is the reason why we see one side of the moon from Earth, and also the reason why there is a so-called dark side, a side which at times, therefore, is facing the sun and receives more radiation. And this is the reason for the prevalence, in part, of the helium-3 isotope on what are called the Mare planes on the far side of the moon. And so this is also a reason why in the future there are prospective moon missions which may seek to actually mine helium-3 for use as an energy source of some kind, whether for use there or for use back here on Earth if brought back to our planet. But I would imagine this is probably at least one reason that there may be differences in soil composition on one side of the moon from the other. And of course, due to these differences, they also retain heat differently. And so Astronomy Today, returning to the article, they say it's clear from a quick look that the moon's near and far sides look quite different, so it's not surprising that they might retain heat differently. But there's no way to know without actually visiting the far side. And although China has their moon rover up there conducting science experiments on the far side of the moon right now, you know, they aren't going to always be the only ones up there. In fact, in short order, we may be seeing the private sector entering lunar studies as well. This from Moon Daily. Lauren sent this one along, and I want to preface this because John Horak, writing for Moon Daily, ties in a 1924 film with this prospective private moon program that we're about to talk about here in a moment. And John writes, Moon of Israel is an epic 1924 film from the golden era of silent movies and helped launch the directing career of Michael Curtiz of Casablanca fame. He goes on to say that sequels seldom live up to the original, but he says if Israel's plans to put a robotic lander on the moon in February 2019, that's right, like right now, can be considered a sequel, this new Moon of Israel mission, led by the nonprofit company SpaceIL, will be a blockbuster in its own right. Here are some details. The SpaceIL's Bereshit, as it's called, Hebrew, in other words, for in the beginning, will become the first privately funded mission to launch from Earth and land on the moon, and the first spacecraft to propel itself over the lunar surface and landing by hopping on its rocket engine to a second landing spot. So they say that the mission marks yet another milestone, not only in the history and technical arc of space exploration, but also in how humankind goes about space exploration. I mean, as I've said in the past plenty of times, these are very exciting times in which we now live. Now, a little more from the Moon Daily article here. The Bereshit lander is about the size and shape, they say, of a family dinner table, roughly 6 feet in diameter and 4 feet high, weighing about 350 pounds. And that doesn't include the nearly 1,000 pounds of fuel needed to land the spacecraft on the moon. Carrying instrumentation to measure the magnetic field of the moon, a laser reflector provided by NASA, and a time capsule of cultural and historical Israeli artifacts. The mission will rise into space as a secondary payload, like a rideshare passenger aboard a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket. Isn't that fascinating? Here's something to think about, too. You know, when we're talking about sending up cultural artifacts, and we already have a few on the moon. I mean, there's an American flag up there. There's some footprints from previous moon landings, manned missions, and other things, too. But, I mean, in the distant future, you know, God forbid that we have some sort of a cataclysmic something happen here on Earth, and we find that in the future, where we have gone back through a dark ages of sorts, and we find our way back to a point in technological proficiency that we go back to the moon, just imagine what it would be like for a future human who had lost record of earthly travel to the moon, and we find objects up there. I mean, that's kind of far out, but even in a more contemporary sense of things, there was a science paper I read a while back talking about the idea of us finding potential artifacts from perhaps even extraterrestrial civilizations on the moon. That doesn't mean necessarily that they lived there or that they even traveled there, but simply that due to the fact that Earth's atmosphere is far less forgiving when space objects decide to visit here, again, they come into our orbit, and if they are large enough and they are pulled in close enough by Earth's gravity, These objects typically just space rocks, and many of them no larger than a grain of sand, but what happens is they streak through the sky and begin to burn very brightly as a result of the resistance met with the air as they're passing through it. The friction that's caused heats them up quickly, and they begin to burn. Yeah, so let's say that there is some little bit of cosmic trash drifting through space, and it enters Earth's orbit and begins to plummet to our planet. If it's small enough, presumably this object is going to burn up before we ever see it, and we're never going to think anything more of it than the fact that it was probably a shooting star, right? But on the moon, hypothetically, an object could land there and not have the same problem, which is kind of fascinating. And so there was a science paper that I read from a few decades ago, and I've talked about it in the past year on the program too, but again, the idea had been that we would be more likely, due to the forgiving atmosphere of the moon and the likelihood that a object could travel to the lunar surface and not be damaged in the process, you know, at least it would be far more likely to land unscathed there than it would here on Earth. Yeah, essentially we could, hypothetically, get to the moon and find evidences of God knows what. It's highly unlikely, but there's always that possibility. However remote, nonetheless, it remains, and now I do think is the time for open-mindedness. I mean, look at Oumuamua. It may not have been anything more than just a weird-shaped rock. We've talked about that plenty, but I think that experiences like the ones that we've had observing objects like Oumuamua, it's got a lot of astronomers and physicists really thinking differently about what we're seeing out there in the stars. All right, more to think about when we return. I'm Micah Hanks. It is The Graylian Report. Welcome back. I'm Micah Hanks. This is The Graylian Report. Always like to give the name of that artist, by the way. That is Monkey Warhol, as he likes to be known. Kind of like Andy Warhol, right? Alien Syndrome is the song. He sent us that and gave us express permission to play that song on this podcast. We appreciate that. Speaking of people who have sent things into us, I want to go ahead and get to the listener emails now so that we can maximize the time we have with our guest a little later. And a couple of these emails actually kind of tie in not only with what we talked about last week, but a story I want to get to here in just a moment. And yes, last week we touched on the story of the young boy here in North Carolina who was missing for a couple of days. You know, said he was with a bear. Again, to me, it sounds an awful lot like a third man factor kind of a case. And if you're not familiar with that term, we did discuss it last week on the show, but it's based on a book by John Geiger called The Third Man Factor. And I recently learned that he actually co-authored a scientific paper talking about this so-called sensed presence, which he essentially describes in that book. I got a lot of feedback from a lot of you folks, including an email from one of the people who we discussed from a similar circumstance that involved a child who went missing and was miraculously discovered and found alive. Her name was Haley Zega. She's actually 23 years old now. She's an actress. She lives in New York, and she reached out to me and said, you know, my family heard you guys mention my story on the podcast. I was really excited, and I listened. I'd love to talk to you about it if you want. And I thought this couldn't be more serendipitous. So yeah, she's going to join us next week. And from our correspondence, I mean, she just seems really delightful. And definitely, I think, on the same page in the sense of, you know, let's talk about this and not do so sensationally. Just the facts, ladies and gents. So we're going to get into just the specifics about what happened to her. You know, not a bunch of speculation, not a bunch of stuff about portals and, you know, wormholes and all this kind of crazy stuff. Although, indeed, there is a odd aspect to her case. You know, she definitely seems to have been one of those who experienced the so-called sensed presence while she was there alone in the woods as a child. So she's going to join us and talk about that. So getting to the listener emails, because naturally after we talked about Casey Hathaway's story last week, and I hope did a fairly responsible job, you know, an unsational presentation on his case too. Nonetheless, I think with the idea that to me, one likely interpretation based on my reading of other literature and other people's similar experiences, which includes Haley Zega, you know, and her incredible experience in the wilderness alone as a child. I definitely think that young Casey and his remembrance of there being a bear with him, it could have been a dog, could have been nothing, or it very well could have been something akin to a psychological kind of a experience that people have when they are in a situation like that. And that's what John Geiger's book, like we talked about last week, covers. Many people, when they are lost and they're in a situation like that, they feel like they are not alone. And this may be a sort of coping mechanism that helps people survive under otherwise very trying circumstances. But anyway, getting to the emails, Noel writes, "Celestial positioning, my friend. I don't know if somebody brought this up elsewhere, but what if the little boy stumbled across the den of a hibernating bear? At 25 pounds, his slight weight against its might not wake the bear, but that would have provided both shelter and warmth. Just a thought." You know, that's an interesting interpretation, that if there had been a slumbering bear, you know, that he could have found warmth alongside the bear. But I don't know, I dread to think of a child wandering into a cave and finding a hibernating bear while lost in the woods. Although that does remind me, Sheriff Chip Hughes, after we did the show last week, he didn't reach out to us, but he was responding to other media, and there apparently are all kinds of theories. People saying there's no way that that boy could have been right in that same area and not be seen by searchers. He must have been kidnapped. Somebody took that boy and they brought him back. Well, the sheriff has said, look, there is absolutely no evidence that there was any third party involved. There never was. That's why there was not an Amber Alert issued. We have no evidence, no suspects. We think Casey was out there in the woods by himself. Yeah, I mean, that's what happened. And again, corresponding with Haley Zega, I mean, that's what happened to her. You know, she was out there. It was in the spring, but nonetheless, it was really cold at night. She was wet like Casey had been because she was by a river. I'm sure she'll tell us more about that next week. But the point is, there are instances where people can survive, even against the odds. And it does seem that Casey did that. But the fact that he did is so perplexing to many that they cannot imagine there being anything but another person involved. Which brings us to Jeannie's email. Jeannie writes, "Hi, Micah. I wanted to weigh in on the bear question. I realize a lot of people poo-poo the possibility of a Bigfoot protecting this child. But it wouldn't be the first time a child has said he or she has been protected, helped, saved, etc. by a bear or a monkey or even a monster. Now, you and I both know that a bear would be more likely to kill a child and eat it than cuddle and keep the child warm. A monkey would be more likely to do this, but it would be smaller, and this child would have more than likely have called it a monkey. But suppose this animal was really huge, possibly blurring the child's perception of bear versus monkey. Many examples of female Bigfoot taking care of lost children have been reported throughout the Bigfoot mythology. It's been reported that Bigfoot are especially enthralled watching children play. Why hasn't anyone taken a picture of a Bigfoot and a bear and then asked the child if either one of these was what kept him company? That would settle the question and would possibly give credence to the Bigfoot phenomenon. Adults make too much drama out of things. It doesn't take a nuclear physicist to figure out how to settle this question. I'm open-minded about the question of Bigfoot. There's way too much written by witnesses to be a figment of someone's imagination. If just 1/10, hell, if just 1/50 of what has been reported about a big hairy biped is true, we have something out there that is not in the biology books. Thanks, Jean," or Jeannie. I'm not sure. It may be Jean. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing your name. Nonetheless, I appreciate the email, and on the subject of Bigfoot, I have a lot to say about this subject. Okay, you guys, I'm sure, out there in the listening audience can sense that over the years I have become a lot more skeptical. And that's not because I'm just a disbeliever or because I'm not going to entertain possibilities if they don't seem likely. I mean, if anything, my reading of scientific literature and my open-mindedness toward the idea that there are phenomena observable in nature which we have record of, but which has not been ultimately proven and therefore dismissed by the scientific community. Again, if we think about Thomas Kuhn, you know, the philosopher of science, and some of his great writing on the subject. In fact, many philosophers say that his writing on philosophy of science is the most important in that genre of the 20th century. And part of what Kuhn was talking about was the idea that sometimes we are met with an idea and we have ample evidence for an idea or a proposition or of a phenomena in nature, but the scientific community is not prepared to cope with that. It is, and this is what he would have defined as a premature idea. And he says that if you look back at the history of science, time and time again, have there been instances where there was an observable phenomenon, there was good data supporting it, but the community didn't take it seriously for the longest time until there was suddenly so much proof that it was almost absurd to entertain any possibility but that that data and its accumulation was indicative of something, something which ultimately led to the recognition of a scientific reality. Now, when it comes to me being skeptical, it's not because I don't want to believe. It's not because I'm unwilling to believe. If anything, I'm actually very open-minded. And so I'm actually open-minded when it comes to Bigfoot, too. I'm less open-minded than I used to be. When I was younger, I think I just took for granted, based on my interest in the subject and all the documentaries I'd watched, all the books I'd read, and not like a lot of the more modern books that, frankly, are so sensational. I grew up reading what I thought were really good books on the subject. You know, writing by Ivan Sanderson, Peter Byrne, the late Dr. Grover Krantz. Again, when I was young, my father especially was interested in that subject because he had studied anthropology and history in college. And so he had a lot of anthropology textbooks, which I now have, because now that he knows I'm really interested in archaeology and all this stuff, he's like, here, just take all these old books. Some of them are kind of dated, but there's still some really good information. And I remember one of the first books I ever read on anthropology was a book called The Ape That Spoke. And although it was written by a journalist, it was an anthropological book about what might be, what a hypothetical scenario for the evolution of language might have been. And in this book, the general premise was that our early ancestors may have, over a long period of time, developed speech as first a kind of early warning system for alerting others, our kindred, about a predator that may be in the area. And we began to learn that we could not only alert our family members, the arboreal apes that they were probably, Australopithecines and the like, we could not only alert them when there was a threat, but we could also specify the threat by emulating the sound that that threat made, or having an arbitrary sound, unrelated but nonetheless that would be identified as meaning that creature is coming our way. And we can observe similar behaviors among varieties of primate species even today. And so the idea that that language evolved basically as a trick, and that it was something that first was conducive to survival. We can warn our friends that there's a danger in the area. We're all safe, and therefore strengthen numbers, and we're all the better for it. So as a survival mechanism of sorts, an adaptation, language might have evolved out of that. And in different places and in different ways around the world, and hence we have different languages, it gets a lot more deep than that. And again, there are probably competing theories. I'm sure that there may be a linguistic anthropologist listening who would go, that is absolutely wrong. And so let me be clear, it was a theory proposed in a book that may not be the only theory or, in truth, the way that language came to exist. But it was, nonetheless, a theory that was proposed of a possible origin of language. And so that was one of the first books I read when I was maybe still in grade school or early middle school on that subject. And it really got me interested in the idea of our early ancestors when they began to exhibit behaviors that were more akin to what we observe in humans today. And so the first article that I ever actually published back in 2004 was looking at the linguistics angle in relation to claims of Sasquatch encounters people had had. And what I tried to do was look throughout literature where people claimed that they had heard vocalizations. And so that was the first article I actually ever wrote. They published it in Fate magazine. At that time, yeah, I'm sure I was much more open-minded. If anything, I probably just took for granted based on the clarity and detail of some of these reports. I was like, this has got to be a reality. As time has gone on, though, and as I have educated myself more on other aspects of science and, you know, on just general critical thinking, one of the big problems that we see with Sasquatch, open-minded though I remain to that possibility, one of the problems I think we see is that with all of the data and all the information and mythology and all of the eyewitness sightings of even the modern era, I mean, there's an incredible lack of physical evidence, it seems. Although you might say that there is definitely some physical evidence, and that's what Grover Krantz and others argued when they talked about the footprints. In fact, he proposed a taxonomical name for Bigfoot based on the footprint evidence that alone, he said, was enough to convince him that a actual biological entity existed, and that this was probably a species critically endangered and in extreme decline. And to me, the problem is that, again, I'm skeptical, and I'm not going to say I think Bigfoot exists. I believe. I think he's out there. It's fine if other people do. I reserve judgment because I say I'm interested in that subject, but I have to also look at the fact that there is that what appears to be an utterly damning lack of physical proof, at least enough physical proof to really substantiate and really embolden our theories and propel that idea that this is something that could exist. We need to get out there and find it. The scientific community doesn't seem to be excited enough based on what little evidence exists to make the case for its existence and therefore to go look for it. But then again, coming back to Thomas Kuhn again for a moment, that's kind of the whole point that he made. He said it may not actually be that there is so little evidence. It may seem, in other words, that despite that evidence, the idea of a creature like Bigfoot existing is such an absurd idea that many scientists will not entertain even the possibility. And they don't. That's the thing. I sadly feel like I have a lot of people in the scientific community that I really look up to, you know, the Daniel C. Dennett's, you know, and the Richard Dawkinses and the people like that. And for ideological reasons in the past, I admired them less, but as I have come to appreciate their work and read their work and understand their theories and the groundwork that they've laid in terms of our science of biology, evolution, our understanding of nature, again, I've really grown to appreciate a lot of these great scientific minds so much more in recent years. And so something that kind of troubles me is the fact that despite my appreciation for their work, I know if I were to probably ever have that opportunity to have the sit down with Richard Dawkins, and we're having a great discussion about evolutionary theory and things, and then Sasquatch comes up, I mean, he'd probably run me out of the room. And I can totally see why. But I do think that if we understand the past, the history of science, there are certainly instances where we have seen that an idea like Thomas Kuhn wrote was premature and therefore overlooked by a scientific community that was unwilling to entertain what seemed like an absurd idea, despite some evidence to the contrary. Sasquatch, as the late Dr. John Bindernagel argued, and citing Kuhn's work when he did, Sasquatch may be one of those premature scientific ideas, and there are some really good biologists, some in the scientific community, that are open to that possibility. Of course, Jeffrey Meldrum is one of them, but he is also someone who is an advocate for the existence of the creature based on the evidence before him. His study indicates to him that this is a reality. This is not speculation. The creature exists. That's where Meldrum seems to come at this. Now, on the more skeptical side, a guy who I've reached out to and invited on the program, and he has said in the future he would like to do that, but that he's very busy right now. But that's Darren Naish of the Tetrapod Zoology blog and podcast now. And he's, of course, a former blogger for Scientific American. Darren, he is far more skeptical, but he's also open to the possibility. And he is someone who pretty frequently on his blogs talks about the possibility that a creature like Sasquatch could exist. And again, I think that very much like I do, he is a person who scientifically recognizes that possibility, but does not give himself to belief because in the spirit of scientific skepticism, he hasn't been convinced by the evidence that he has seen. And it's funny for me to have come from a position more like Meldrum over to a position more like Naish. But I think it's a respectable position in the sense that I'm being cautious. I don't give myself to belief. That's not what we do if we try to think scientifically. And that kind of caution and skepticism is the kind of ideology I try to present for you on this podcast in the spirit of critical thinking, rather than in the spirit of sensationalism, pure entertainment, speculation, and frankly, just shoving garbage at my listenership, like a lot of podcasts these days do. And I'm not attacking anybody or naming names because I've got a lot of good friends in the community who present information and present it in a way that I don't think is as responsible as I try to be on this show. And if people enjoy that, that's fine. The only problem I have with it, with all respect to my buddies in the podcasting community, is that when people listen to that and then they accept that as being their reality, well, I heard it on this podcast, therefore I believe it exists. I believe that this is one way or that is another. And so I have a lot of friends who, frankly, are very given to things like superstition. I mean, I have family members, friends, colleagues who, there are certain subjects I talk about on this podcast, even though skeptically, that they don't enjoy talking about or hearing about because they frighten them. And that's the whole thing. We all enjoy a good story, a good ghost story, or a thriller novel, or a horror movie on a dark, stormy night. You know, we always enjoy those stories. But when these kinds of subjects are presented rather than as a scientific possibility, like Thomas Kuhn and others would have advocated, something that there does seem to be data which may support the existence of, when these things instead are presented just for the thrill factor, they are essentially presented on podcasts as scary stories with the express intent and purpose of thrilling the listener and sometimes scaring them, people actually have a negative reaction sometimes to the kinds of things we talk about. People are afraid of Sasquatch or of what they perceive as alien visitation to Earth, whether or not UFOs actually even represent that. And they certainly aren't taken seriously by scientists if all they are campfire stories. So again, no offense to anybody who enjoys a good story. I love them too. And from time to time, we love to tell a good story on this podcast. But the way I try to be different from my friends in the podcasting community or authors or people who go on TV shows, again, rather than making these just stories for the sake of entertainment, I try to look at the science side of this and make the science side entertaining. I try to entertain you guys as much as any other podcast, but through the lens of critical thinking, skepticism, and science. Now, let's come back to Bigfoot again for a moment. You know, when Jeannie writes in and says we shouldn't rule out the possibility of the existence of a creature like Bigfoot, I completely agree with that. Whether or not I necessarily agree with the idea that that may be the ultimate solution to how Casey Hathaway survived a couple of days in frigid temperatures, I haven't seen any evidence that that's the case. Maybe someone could show him a photograph of a Bigfoot or a bear, and maybe he would point at the Bigfoot and say, yep, that's my buddy. But does that really solve the mystery? Or does that merely say that, hey, this is just one way that the child might be introduced to some information that he would identify as being what helped him survive? Right now he says a bear. My theory, and again, it is merely a theory, as we discussed last week, is that this third man factor thing might be one interpretation, where the ultimate explanation, and perhaps the most likely one, is rooted in psychology. And I think that that is a more rational approach to understanding all of the factors that are seen without giving ourselves to, therefore he was saved by Bigfoot. But at very least in general terms, scientifically speaking, I'm very open-minded to the possibility that, and maybe even the case for open-mindedness in relation to study of a creature like Bigfoot, because as absurd as it may seem, and I understand and even have to say that I respect why scientists would rule it out of hand. It does seem absurd. But if we look at things in terms of evolutionary history, is it that absurd? Have there not been, at different periods throughout the evolutionary history of humankind, creatures that very much resembled our ancestors, in fact, but that nonetheless resembled what we hear in reports of Bigfoot today? Does it not generally resemble creatures known to exist on Earth today? I love when I hear people saying, there's no way that a bipedal primate like that could exist in North America. And I'm like, have you looked in the mirror? I mean, humans, hello. Yeah, but we're not hidden. Well, no, we're not. No, we're not. But, I mean, the idea that a creature like this could not exist, I've actually heard some scientists make that argument. They're like, no, it couldn't exist. I'm thinking, well, if we look at humans, at very least we could agree that, yes, it could exist. Now, whether it's likely that a creature like this, presumably a species apart from ourselves, could exist, could remain hidden, could feed itself in remote environments like the Pacific Northwest. And see, that's one of the big problems with Bigfoot. Many have looked at that and said, what in the world would a creature in a very extreme environment like that eat? But again, to play devil's advocate, we do see that there are some instances where even humans can survive in adverse conditions, granted for a limited amount of time. If we were talking about a larger animal that is more adapted to that environment, could it exist in that environment? Again, many scientists, many biologists would say impossible. Nothing as big as Bigfoot could live in the Pacific Northwest. And I say, but you've got to keep in mind, of the three species of bear in North America, the largest exists in that same part of the world. We also have some of the largest species of elk or moose, some of the largest birds anywhere. Again, it seems that in that part of the world, the extremes of that environment seem to necessitate a larger body mass for survival to even occur. So while many use that as the argument against the existence of a creature like Bigfoot, I say, hey, this may not be evidence, but if we're going to be intellectually honest, we have to acknowledge that many of the largest animals of their kind do exist in that part of the world. They do find enough to eat. And if you listen to the anecdotal reports where people say that they see Bigfoot, what do they describe? They describe largely an omnivorous diet where they are subsisting off of a lot of foliage, and they are always around during the salmon runs. Even the Native American legends say that, you know, the fishermen always knew during the salmon run when they would go out and collect fish, never leave fish tied up or laying around because Sasquatch would come and steal it. They're hungry, and they like salmon. Again, this may sound absurd to the more skeptically minded, but I see some of the arguments against how and why a creature like that might or might not exist. I mean, they often contradict one another. And that to me seems to indicate that people make up their minds whether or not they believe in something first, and then they make the argument based on the evidence. It's kind of funny, if you think about it, that that evidence, depending on how you spin it, could be used in either argument. And therein lies the problem. So, Jeannie, thank you for your email. Again, I don't think I can give myself to the idea that Bigfoot cozied up to the little boy and kept him warm. That's just for my part. I'm going to be honest with you about that, though. You know I will. But I'm definitely open-minded to the possibility that a creature like that could exist. I'm just waiting for more evidence. I'm also willing, when that evidence is forthcoming, to treat it seriously. And I think that truly, in the name of good science and skepticism, other biologists, other anthropologists, other evolutionary scientists, they need to be too. But we need to do it skeptically. There's a right and a wrong way to do things. And so on this podcast, I may not always be right, but I'm always going to do my best to try and give you guys the best story I can. Okay, look, when we come back from this break, I want to touch on a little bit more in the way of biology. There's been a lot going on in the news, but I mentioned that Adam Olson sent me a really great story. And this one has to do with certain animals that appear at certain times and other things observable in nature that may be associated with them. Let's try and separate some of the myth from the reality when we return. I am Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylin Report. We'll be right back. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylin Report. Glad, as always, to be able to be with you guys. Short segment here, and then we're going to be bringing on Rod Pyle to talk about interplanetary robots. Really excited to talk about him, or talk about that subject with him. And that is, of course, the title of his book. More on that in just a bit. First, this story that was sent along to me by Adam Olson. This is in Forbes. Boy, Forbes has had some really interesting content recently. We had this commentary on Megan Fox's new archaeology show that David Anderson wrote. That was really good. Well, this is David Bresson, different David, writing for Forbes about an equally interesting subject. And the headline reads, "Giant oarfish warning of coming earthquake and tsunami is more myth than science." Now, this always made sense to me, actually, because, again, the idea of a deep sea fish appearing washed ashore might be indicative of things going on, often associated with tsunamis and the like. I mean, again, it seems to make sense peripherally, but he makes the argument here that maybe that is more myth than anything. And he references Japanese folklore that plays into this and says, "Some researchers believe that the myth of what's known as the Namazu is based on people noting unusual behavior of catfish before an earthquake. However, folklorists noted that the history behind the myth is much more complicated. Namazu is considered to be one of the so-called yokai, that is, creatures of mythology and folklore causing misfortune and disasters. Namazu depictions have been known since the 15th century, however, and it was only in the late 18th century that the catfish became associated with natural disasters." Now he says, in the Tokugawa period, which was basically from the 1600s up to the middle 1800s, the catfish, they said, was a river deity associated with floods or heavy rainfall. Namazu often warns people from an imminent catastrophe or swallows dangerous water dragons, and thereby preventing further disasters. But over time, the catfish gradually replaces other animals, like water dragons, giant eel, or the dragon beetle Jinshin Mushi, or also the earth-shaking yokai. He says, "The history of such myths also explains in part why some animals, especially fish, are still regarded as a harbinger of disasters in Japan." He says, "The giant oarfish, a deep-water creature living at depths from 650 to 3,300 feet, is the longest bony fish in the world, growing to 15 feet or more. It's presumed to be responsible for some sea serpent sightings by European sailors. In Japan, it is believed to be sent by the Dragon King of the Sea to warn people along the coast of an impending earthquake or tsunami. Earlier this week, a 10.5-foot specimen washed up on the shore of the Toyama Bay on the Sea of Japan and other locations. Now, he goes on to say here, at least a dozen oarfish had washed up onto Japan's coastline in the year prior to the 2011 Fukushima earthquake and subsequent tsunami, which sparked articles about the supposed connection between sightings and earthquakes. In July of 2015, a live oarfish was caught near Santa Catalina Island off the southern coast of California. It was the third oarfish spotted in 19 months in the water surrounding the island, or that was actually washed ashore. In 2014, one specimen was washed ashore along the Santa Monica coastline, and in 2013, in just a week, two specimens were found dead on the shores of Santa Catalina Island. Some media searched for a connection between oarfish sightings and earthquake activity along the San Andreas Fault, but none was found. And he says biologists have proposed various explanations why oarfish periodically are spotted at the surface of the sea or found dead along shores. They aren't the greatest swimmers, and seasonal currents could push them up to the surface, where they eventually die from exhaustion. There are more exotic explanations, he goes on to note here, which involve gases or chemical compounds released by underwater fishers, poisoning or even killing animals in the sea. But at the end of the day, he says, there is no statistically significant link between the behavior of animals and seismic activity to be found, and further, that there is, to date, no increased seismic activity in the oceans surrounding Japan that is being reported. By the way, Bresson is a freelance geologist. Now, that's kind of interesting because, again, there is some literature, some science literature, which obviously he probably is not an advocate of, and I don't know that it necessarily unequivocally points to this idea, but as he is arguing against links between animal behavior and seismic activity, there is some data in science literature that has proposed that there could be such links. Again, it remains on the table maybe whether that is to be proven, and hence he says there is no significant link statistically between the behavior of animals and seismic activity. You do hear about stories, though, like animals prior to an earthquake, and I've observed this firsthand. Right before an earthquake occurred here in western North Carolina, a couple of Rottweilers I was house-sitting a few years ago actually started just howling uncontrollably. I'm like, guys, really, what is going on here? And lo and behold, I get a phone call a few minutes later, and they were like, yeah, there was an earthquake. And a lot of people were talking about their animals reacting to it seemingly before the earthquake occurs. Now, what's kind of interesting to me about this is something else that reportedly occurs before earthquakes are the ever enigmatic earthquake lights. And there are, if you go back into legends and you look in different parts of the world, there are associations made between so-called ghost lights appearing and misfortune. And something I had speculated about at that time was, well, what if the earthquake lights that are sometimes seen prior to an earthquake was or could have been the reason for the association made between those lights that appear in nature, once perceived as being something otherworldly, something supernatural, and which, again, you can find videos online. Boy, that sounds really scientific. No, really, there's proof. Go online. Look, there's videos. Haven't you heard of YouTube? But all kidding aside, there are some videos that do appear to show aurora-like phenomena emanating from the ground, which again, geologists and experts in the study of seismic phenomena have looked at and said, yeah, this seems to be a valid representation of what have been referred to anecdotally as earthquake lights, or again, more commonly in folklore mythology prior to that, ghost lights and things like that. Nothing unnatural about them if we can attribute to them a scientific explanation. And so to me, again, I understand why scientifically speaking, statistically speaking, there may not be connections between the appearances of oarfish and earthquakes, tsunamis, etc. But I can definitely see why certain phenomena in nature in the past actually have been associated with ill fortune, bad omens, death, destruction, things like that. It makes sense. People in the ancient world, they see something in a pre-scientific era that they can't explain. And all they know is that, hey, when that shows up, we know to duck and cover because there's going to be an earthquake or whatever else may be the case. So at least in some instances, I could actually see why the connections exist. But again, to separate the myth or the superstition from the potentially plausible scientific phenomena and their association with other things. So anyway, before we wrap up this hour and get our guest Rod Pyle on, who I'm really eager to talk with, just a couple of things. I do want to make one brief announcement and then get to the aforementioned ghost rocket report from the 1940s, which I promised. First, the announcement. My good pals over at the Grimerica podcast are doing an event this year with another friend of mine and of the program, Randall Carlson. And those of you who listen to the Seven Ages audio journal got to hear some of our conversing and commiserating with Randall Carlson last fall when we were doing one of our archaeology field trips. And Randall was a wonderful host. We took him out to dinner, and then he brought us back to his house, and we spent several hours delving into geology, history, really study of the ancient past in general. And it's been a true joy to be able to introduce him to Jason and James, the guys that I work with. And so the Seven Ages team and I, you know, we went and spent some good time with him back in the fall. And so that's one reason I'm really excited to see that he's going to be at this event that the Grimerica guys are putting on, which they affectionately call Contact at the Cabin. But also that Randall's going to be joining us on this podcast. And it's funny because I've been to his house. The Seven Ages guys and I have met him on several occasions. Jason's met him twice now. James, you know, finally got to hit it off with him. And boy, talk about interesting, hearing the two geologists talking about ancient catastrophism and geology together. That was just really truly a meeting of the minds. And yet, after all the years I've known Randall Carlson, I've been to events where he's been speaking. He's attended lectures where I was a speaker. You know, we've been friends before all else. And, of course, now we hope to be able to travel and do some research together, too. And yet he's never officially been a guest on this podcast. What is up with that? And so I'm happy to be able to say that on February 18th, he's going to be a guest on this program. That is 2 weeks from today. And, of course, next week, my guest will be the very wonderful Haley Zega, who I think is really going to change a lot of our attitudes and perceptions of what is going on in the wilderness when people go missing, because Haley is one of those people. I am so excited about these upcoming conversations, including the one that we're about to have with Rod Pyle about interplanetary robots. Like I told you guys at the beginning of the year, I wanted to set a new precedent for the kinds of content we would provide on this program. It's kind of like with those bumper stickers you see on the backs of 18-wheelers when you're driving down the highway. There's a number and it says, call and tell me how I'm doing. What do you think so far? I think that we are doing better than ever on this podcast. Different guests, unique content, interesting themes, discussion. And of course, as always, I'm giving you my thoughts on things too. But coming back to the friends of this program, that's why it's important to me to see guys like Randall Carlson getting out there and doing what he does. And so my buddies at Grimerica, having him at their event makes it all the more important. And so I'm kind of just dropping an Easter egg for you right now as it relates to the Contact at the Cabin thing. I won't say much more right now. I'm going to mention it again next week. And then, of course, look forward to having Randall on this podcast on February 18th. In the meantime, do check out this URL, though. Okay, if you go to badcomet.com, that is the website where you can learn about Contact at the Cabin, the event that Grimerica is holding this year. I'm sure space is kind of limited, so the sooner that you check into that, the better. But again, this thing is full on and go, and Randall will be there. Who knows if I can make time? I may try to get up there too. This really looks like it'll be a lot of fun. So again, badcomet.com. Contact at the Cabin is the event, badcomet.com. Do check that out. Randall Carlson, May 2019 at Pagosa Springs, Colorado, with the Grimerica gang. Really looking forward to seeing where they go with this, and getting Randall back on this program. He and I have a lot to talk about, but we always do. That's just kind of how it goes. Okay, one more thing before we get Rod Pyle on the program to join us. So I was digging through some old newspapers the other day, and I found something really interesting. Okay, now this has been an ongoing project of mine, and I'll probably do something more with it at some time. Right now I'm still in the research phases, but I've always got four or five different projects going on. And this is one of my interesting historical project, you know, looking back through newspaper archives in the United States and elsewhere and looking for just interesting things. And from time to time, I'll have something specific in mind. And I've done something similar with newspapers recently that I had done in the past with the Aviation Safety Reporting System, where I was looking for reports of anomalous things reported by pilots and the crew aboard aircraft. And there are some really weird ones that have been reported to the Aviation Safety Reporting System over the last few years. But we have this report. This one goes back to, and this is a subject near and dear to my heart because I wrote a book called The Ghost Rockets that talked about, you know, the history of reports of missiles and missile-related incidents that are kind of unusual, and some of them do point to the idea that there have been developmental programs which were aimed at essentially creating guided missiles and things like that, and that there were similar technologies seen even before guided missiles as we know them today existed. And certainly there are still sightings of missile or rocket-like objects, some of which, to me, I think in the modern era are a lot more like drones that are reported by aviation professionals and pilots even today. But the name is borrowed from a phenomenon that was occurring over Scandinavia in the 1940s, known as the Ghost Rockets. And from the Wilmington Morning Star, on the date of August 12, 1946, again right here in my home state of North Carolina, this is the story that was featured, and this is really weird. It says, "Not rocket bomb." And I want to read this story to you, but again, I'll just point out that much like with the aviation safety reporting system, this is what's wonderful about having the World Wide Web at our disposal and databases that are searchable with keywords, because I can search newspapers that have been digitized with keywords, and it will search those actual uploads, these scanned images of newspapers, find said keyword, and I can go back through archives and find things far more efficiently than people have done in years past. Just think about all the improvements and the information that we have access to, and we'll be able to find and sift through much more quickly in the coming era. I mean, we can do it right now. That's part of the reason I'm interested in looking at newspapers and trying to find interesting esoteric data, right? Kind of Fortean, really, if you think about it. Very similar to the tradition of Charles Hoy Fort sitting there in the New York Public Library and digging through periodicals, science journals, things like that. And then after he did it, of course, many years later, William R. Corliss did it with science publications. I tried to do the same thing, and I'll also look at newspapers. So you do a search for a term like rocket or ghost rocket, mystery rocket, unusual aerial phenomena, things like this. And specifically, I'm interested in seeing what turns up prior to the so-called modern UFO era, right? After Kenneth Arnold reports seeing objects that the press reported as flying saucers in 1947. So this one from August 1946, a few months before this famous incident over Mount Rainier, Washington, that put us into the modern UFO era, right? But nonetheless, after the Second World War. Listen to this description of one of the so-called ghost rockets seen over Scandinavia. It says, "There's no comparison with the rocket bombs. The mystery missiles are small and at low altitudes seem almost square. Square-shaped. That's weird. At low altitudes seem almost square. It says the bottom of the object appeared to have been painted red. Eyewitnesses said some observed these missiles flying extremely low. These reports have been substantiated by a Swedish officer, a flyer, who saw one of the rockets during a recent flight." So that's one of the ones I'd found recently. But again, the way it's described doesn't sound much like a rocket, does it? I mean, these things flying, they're square-shaped. They look like they've been painted red, flying at fairly low altitude. I mean, what in the world? Here's another, and this one from Copenhagen, right? It says, and this is, again, a really weird report. Copenhagen, August 29th, and this also from 1946, reported by the Associated Press. It says, "Dispatches from the Aalborg in northern Jutland today quoted residents of a small village in that area as saying a mysterious rocket had crashed and exploded just outside the hamlet on Wednesday night." So the report reads. Now, it also says, "One woman," the dispatches said, reported, and then they say he, but obviously it's a typo, "she was standing in her garden when the sky was lit," now listen to this, "by the yellowish glow from a strange missile which passed overhead." Okay, the sky was lit by the yellowish glow. "The object," she said, "crashed with an explosion that was followed by something that looked like a rain of stars." There were a lot of reports of these so-called ghost rockets crashing, and yet they never seemed to really find any debris or anything else that was indicative of the actual physical source. But for those who were saying that, well, these things were just, you know, this is just war nerves, there was nothing being reported but missiles and things like that, for those who have made the argument that the so-called ghost rockets were nothing but missiles, they must not have actually gone through a lot of these newspaper archives and read the actual reports. And in addition to these two reports that I've shared here with you, there was another which showed an actual aircraft which had crashed, portions of it still hanging in a tree, and it said that it had reportedly collided with one of the objects. Now, that may or may not have been the case, but based on these reports given, again, first of all, they don't sound all that much like rockets. Second of all, they certainly don't behave like rockets that we know. And third, it definitely doesn't sound to me like the phenomena being reported was merely war nerves. In other words, people were frightened and on edge because this was just after the Second World War. Or that it was merely astronomical phenomena, you know, meteors, celestial phenomena being observed by people who, once again, had war nerves. They see a meteor streaking through the sky and they think it's a rocket. If anything, these definitely sounded like they were technological in origin. But whose were they? What were they? I don't know that it's necessarily as mysterious as it sounds. And looking back again, this doesn't sound like some sort of an extraterrestrial technology or anything like that. In my book, The Ghost Rockets, that's also something I point out. I said, all indications are that these are earthly technology, but obviously there are aspects of different technological developments that have occurred over the decades, which are not in the official public record, that we do not have a complete and full historical or scientific understanding of. And that doesn't mean that they are truly anomalous or unexplainable, but clearly we don't have all the facts. I would really like to know what all the facts might entail if we had them on hand and right here before us. And maybe more importantly, what would we determine with that data if we had it? Anyway, we're out of time. I want to get to our guest. Rod Pyle will join us when we return right after this. So I'll leave you with a little food for thought on the Ghost Rocket subject. But looking ahead, we're going to be looking at robots that we have been sending into space and what information they have actually sent back our way here on Earth and what we're learning about space-time and the cosmos with their help. I'm Micah Hanks. We'll be joined by Rod here in a moment on the Graylian Report.
Science, space, and the cosmos. Exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks.
Welcome back. It is the second hour of this week's edition of the program. Glad as always to be here in the pocket with you. A bit of a warm pocket here in Appalachia after all this cold we've been having. But again, the temperatures here on Earth, no matter how cold, aren't quite like anything we see further out there in space where we are sending robots right now. And so here in just mere moments, Rod Pyle, author of Interplanetary Robots, True Stories of Space Exploration, will be joining me here on the show to talk about that. Before we get to all that, I do want to remind you guys, if you enjoy this podcast and you would like to support our work but get something to show for it, consider heading over to GraylianReport.com. That's GraylianReport.com/X. And you can sign up right there, become a subscriber. It's just $7 a month or $77 a year. And that, of course, gets you additional content on a weekly basis in the form of the Graylian X podcast and then monthly specials like Graylian Enigmas. We just dropped a new episode of that over the weekend, which I'm sure many of you guys up there have been enjoying, so definitely check it out. Oh, and we are revamping the Micah Hanks YouTube channel. There's going to be a lot of additional content going up over there in the next few days, too. Some of it has already been added. I'm putting interviews, videos, all kinds of things. So you'll be able to see all of that over there. Just look for Micah Hanks on YouTube with a Graylian Report. And so without further ado, I'm really eager to get into this discussion. My guest today is Rod Pyle, a space and astronomy writer, lecturer, and educator. He has a master's degree from Stanford University and a Bachelor of Fine Arts from the Arts Center College of Design. He studied astronomy and geology at UCLA and worked in public outreach at the Griffith Observatory in Los Angeles. He's written several books, including Interplanetary Robots, True Stories of Space Exploration. And I want to lead off briefly with a quote from another astronomer who I respect and admire, and this is what he had to say about this book. He said, if machines ever replace us, they'll want to keep Pyle on hand to do what he does for our interplanetary robots, personalize their stories, spotlight what's important, and explain why with wit and wonder. This book is a first-class seat on all these unmanned spacecraft. That was E.C. Krupp, director of the Griffith Observatory, and author of one of my favorite books on archaeoastronomy, Echoes of the Ancient Skies. So that's quite a compliment.
Yeah, I was really thrilled to get that. I worked with Dr. Krupp for a better part of a decade. I say with, I worked for him. I was the head docent up there for a while. And he was just a pleasure and really took the mission of running. You know, it's not easy to run a museum like that, especially when it's city-owned. But he kept his hand firmly on the helm for decades, and they finally had this huge renovation in the early 2000s. And it's just a spectacular place if you ever get a chance to go up there. That's Griffith Observatory in L.A.
I really hope to. Absolutely. And, of course, I always enjoy history and archaeology almost as much as I enjoy astronomy by itself, but when you can mix the two together, that's great. Krupp does that, and you do that with your writing. You are as much a historian to me, Rod, as you are an expert on space travel, interplanetary robots, and the like, which are the subject of your new book. You know, one thing that definitely comes to mind with this, we don't know if there's life elsewhere in our solar system, but we're certain that other worlds in our planetary neighborhood are inhabited because of the robots we've sent there. So, you know, really, what is the scope of this book and what got you interested specifically in the robotic side of space exploration?
So the scope of the book, I've been accused of being a little JPL biased. That's the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, NASA's field center on the West Coast in Southern California for robotic space exploration. And I got a cop to that. You know, part of it is it's just easier to get solid material from the American program that is from the Soviet program. And we really had this second space race going on in the 1960s. There's the one we all know about, which is racing the Soviets to get to the moon before the end of that decade. But there's a secondary program in both countries to try and achieve space first with robots. And robots were not very robust back in that day. You know, there are even plans to do some of these later as missions with human crews because we were so uncertain of our robotic capabilities. But there was a really robust program in the Soviet Union. It's just a little harder to get the straight dope on some of those missions. And I also worked up at JPL off and on over the years as a contractor writing for them. So I do have kind of a bias that way, which I admit to. And I think it was what really got me interested in the robotic program was I grew up with Apollo, so I had witnessed all that firsthand, and that was an incredible time to be alive, just nothing like it. I mean, there was a period of time in the late 60s, early 70s, where these incredible missions of lunar exploration were taken off as frequently as every couple of months.
Oh, yeah.
And it was an amazing thing to watch. But then in 1976, the first Viking lander was going to set down on Mars, and that was huge. That was a program that had been in the making for, depending on how you parse the numbers, about 15 years at least. And because I live in Pasadena, California, I was able to go down to Caltech, and they weren't letting the public in the auditorium because it was a press-only event at that point. But having grown up here, I kind of knew some of the back ways in, so I snuck in there and got sort of a slightly askance look from some of the journalists there because I didn't have a badge. Like, who's this kid? What's he doing here? But to be there for that first landing and see that first picture come back, which was not of the horizon, interestingly enough, which drew grumbles from some of the journalists. It was a shot of the lander's foot pad because they wanted to make sure they had set down safely on stable terrain. But to me, that was such a magic moment, is this culmination of Ray Bradbury's Martian Chronicles, of Edgar Rice Burroughs and Princess of Mars, and this lore that we had inherited from Percival Lowell back around the turn of the 19th century of a potentially life-hosting planet. And although it didn't turn out to be that, and we knew that in the 60s once Mariner 4 flew past, it was still just an amazing moment to be there when that first robot set down on another planet, soft landing, incredibly successful, operated for years. And I think that's really what got me fired up about the robotic program. So I've just been a real devotee of that ever since.
Yeah. I mean, what you're seeing right there, and you've described eloquently for us there, is watching science fiction step over into reality. And now we are actually, I mean, we haven't made it to the red planet ourselves, but we have put our technology there. And in a sense, we are already exploring. I mean, we're in every sense already exploring Mars. And to see it, you know, be lifted off of the science fiction page and enter this new era where these discoveries are becoming reality, I could see, I mean, I don't know how anyone could not be excited by that. And, you know, Rod, we've got a little news that's been breaking recently, although it's been really kind of a prolonged story for the last 6 months. Over the weekend, it was reported that NASA will be making a final attempt to restore communication with the Opportunity rover there on Mars, which might have been, I think, damaged during a dust storm. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, it had been, those machines all incur a lot of wear and tear because Martian soil, it's really nasty stuff. It hasn't rained there in millions, if not billions of years. And the soil is very fine-grained, a lot of sharp edges, and it's chemically toxic. So it's very tough on those rovers. And for Opportunity to have been operating like it did ever since 2004 when it set down, and it really was the machine that sort of wrote the history of water on Mars. The Curiosity rover, of course, famously was able to drill and discover the detailed history of water in Gale Crater, where it landed. But it was Opportunity that first discovered those little blackberries, those little concretions of hematite that were left in various strata around different parts of the planet where it traveled. Drove for 30 miles almost, really just charted this history of water on the planet at a time when we really didn't understand what had happened to the water and how much there was. So between that machine and the orbiters, we built up this sort of detective-based history. A lot of it's by inference, and they're very clever about that.
Oh, yeah.
At JPL and NASA at large, of the fact that this was once a very wet planet and that there's enough water locked up in ice around the world to cover it something like a level of about 30 feet of ocean. So that was really the amazing thing about Opportunity and the MER rovers in general. Sadly, what happened was we had a global Mars dust storm, which happens every few years. Started in May of last year, went on for a couple of months. And unlike the Mars 2020 rover, which has a nuclear fuel supply, the Opportunity was powered by solar panels. And it just got so dark for so long, the batteries ran down. Apparently, the heaters may have finally run out of power, and it just couldn't withstand, as far as we can tell, the sort of de facto Martian night that it was subjected to for months and months. So they hoped that it would reboot and spring back once it got enough solar power to charge the batteries up, but it doesn't look like that happened. So they set a timeline to listen and keep trying to make contact. It was short. It was going to end by the end of last year, and there was a lot of pushback from the science community, understandably, people that have been associated with this program for decades. So they extended it, but at a certain point, you just have to give up and say, okay, the mission's over. Mm-hmm. We did a great job. It fulfilled. I mean, it was only supposed to last a few months.
Right.
So, you know, it's well beyond its warranty already. So
yeah.
That was sensational.
Had a pretty good run, but who knows? I mean, they're going to try one last time, as I understand it. So we have high hopes. We'll see what happens. Now, Opportunity was sent up there in 2004. It's, of course, not the only artificial object on Mars. In fact, I think there's at least 15 of them, if we count all of ours, the old Soviet projects going all the way back to Mars 2. But now you were actually on hand also at JPL's Von Karman Auditorium, I believe, in 2012 when Curiosity was making its landing too, right?
Yeah, what an evening that was. So I'd gone up at midday, and it was a typical hot afternoon in San Gabriel Valley in Southern California, because that's what we get is heat and smog. So going into Von Karman was always a welcome change because it's a very nice venue. It's air-conditioned, which is the most important thing. And we were able to watch the big screen up front. They had this computer graphic up with Mars squarely in the crosshairs from the point of view of just looking over the shoulder of the spacecraft as it was airing in there. And the thing that some people don't know about the current crop of Mars landers is, in Viking, back in the 70s, there were two spacecraft, each comprised of an orbiter and a lander. And when they went to Mars, they went into orbit and then dallied there while they were able to look down and really use their close-up cameras, the telescopic cameras, to define the best parking place you can find down the orbit, the best place to land. With all the missions since then that have had landers, it's just a straight shot. It's like a hunting rifle. You aim it at where Mars is going to be when you get there. You shoot it. And you hope you've calculated everything correctly, so it enters the atmosphere just around the edge enough to slow down with the heat shield and parachute down and land exactly in that spot within a few dozen miles either direction. So it's really a remarkable achievement. In addition, of course, for Curiosity, we had this wacko sky crane thing, which when most, I'm not an engineer, but even the engineers I know when they first saw it that weren't involved in the mission, we're looking at this thing, so it had to come down to a hover, and then it lowered the rover by these four tethers, and then cut them loose, and the rocket pack had to go crash somewhere else. And if one of the tethers didn't separate, the rocket pack could drag the rover on its side. There are all these potential points of failure. But I had, for that previous book called Curiosity, I had interviewed Rob Manning, who I've known for, I guess, about 10, 15 years now, who was the chief engineer on that mission, and now he's the chief engineer at JPL overall. And I said, you know, what were you thinking? I mean, really, is this the easiest way to do it? And he said, you know, going down like we normally do it, and like a lot of the foreign powers are still trying to do it, you put a rover on top of a lander. That's what the Chinese did with their most recent lunar probe that landed on the far side of the moon. You put a rover on top of a lander. It's a little bit like balancing a bowling ball on top of a broomstick. You know, it's very tippy, And then once you're down there, you've got the problem of driving off the landing stage and so forth. And he said, this is the best way and the simplest way with the fewest points of failure we can figure out to deliver this giant rover and its own wheels of the landing gear. So seeing that succeed was just breathtaking. And then, of course, seeing the jubilation of all the people involved in the mission and the entry, descent, and landing team as they came in later screaming and cheering and wearing their cool shirts was just almost too much. It was great.
Absolutely. Again, history in the making, and it just goes to show how much, you know, there is an actual historical component to this. You do a brilliant job reporting that. We're talking with Rod Pyle, an author, and of course his latest book is Interplanetary Robots, True Stories of Space Exploration. Rod, let's talk a little about the history of space probes and roboticized space exploration, because again, this isn't a new concept, and basically all of our explorations of space beyond the moon have been achieved only in one or two ways. We use telescopes and equipment from here on Earth that helps us visualize what's going on deeper in space, and then there are the interplanetary robots you've written about in this book. So let's talk about that, the concept and its history going back even earlier than some of the missions that we're talking about right now.
So this really sprang to life in the 50s when we realized we had machines that could get these probes off Earth and into orbit and beyond. And the Soviets were early into that with their shots towards the moon. And like ours in the early days, a lot of them either went flying past the moon and missed it or smacked in the surface, sometimes by design, sometimes not. But there are a lot of failures. And back in the day, computers were very primitive. Robotics was really in its earliest stages. We had always sort of envisioned from the 1920s on the idea of these machines that walk around looking like people and smoking cigarettes and driving cars and cleaning your house and all that. And that's not how it turned out. You know, they turned out to be very function-driven. But it was really those earliest days in the late 50s, early 1960s that sort of defined the path this is all going to take. And as I mentioned earlier, at the time, there was enough concern about the lack of reliability in these machines that they were planning, at one point, the U.S., and I know the Soviets had similar plans, they were planning to use leftover Apollo hardware after the lunar landings to send a flyby mission with men in it, with astronauts, to sling around Venus, drop robots on the way, and control them while they were flying past the planet for about 10 hours. And then hope that they continue operating after we left. And that was never done, of course. Yeah. It's a good thing, because now that we know what we know about space, the radiation would have soaked those guys. But that's how uncertain they were. And it was really a lot of baby steps to get these things to be able to do what they do so well now. And the big twist now, excuse me, there are two things. One is miniaturization, and one is artificial intelligence. So when you've got something like New Horizons, that you just flew past that target a billion miles past Pluto called Ultima Thule, you know, they're something like 10 or 12 hours away from mission control one way. So that's a long, long time for a radio signal to go out and come back, and you can't control it with a joystick. So it's got to know what to do. So between that and making these things smaller and lighter and easier to launch and control with the advanced intelligence of the computers, you're really entering a whole new era of this. And they just flew a couple of CubeSats, those little things are about half the size of a shoebox, along with the latest Mars lander, Mars InSight. That's the first time that those kind of devices have gone beyond Earth orbit and towards another planet. So with the success of that experiment, I think you're going to see more and more of these small, very light robots. You can launch a bunch of them with one rocket going off and really starting to reconnoitre the solar system in great detail.
Yeah, which just so fascinating. You also touch on two aspects of technology that both are fascinating to me and that are a little concerning. One is miniaturization. I mean, that's been something that's just a general trend technologically. I mean, things over time, as really, I think, as far as electronic components go, you know, moving over from transistors to solid state kind of helped with miniaturization. And that's something that we see almost in all areas of technological innovation and development. Phones, televisions, everything. I mean, leaner, meaner, more efficient. Generally, it is a trend towards smaller and more efficient technology. Not surprising that that's happening in space. But when you bring artificial intelligence into this, you know, there are some real interesting questions on the horizon as it relates to that. And another guy that we're going to talk about a little as it relates to space programs and the privatization of space travel a little later, Elon Musk, he's very concerned about artificial intelligence. You know, what kind of applications are we seeing with, you know, really, Rod, I would call it pre-AI. It's not fully autonomous AI, but it's definitely innovating and changing the way that space exploration occurs. How are we seeing it being implemented right now?
So we're not yet looking, at least in the space program side, we're not yet looking at Terminators. You know, they're not going to take over the planet anytime soon. They're not going to change their mind and head back to Earth orbit and shower us with some kind of devastating attack from above or anything. These are very basic machines. And the thing that's interesting to me and isn't reported on that much about these computers that are flying on these interplanetary probes, they're old. Mm-hmm. You know, they have to use chips that have been hardened against radiation because the solar system is very hostile once you leave the Earth's magnetosphere. There's a lot of radiation out there, especially as you got it towards Jupiter and Saturn. The radiation is just devastating. So the chips they're using are usually at least 15 to 20 years old. So some of these designs on New Horizons, the basic chip design that they're using on that computer was baselined in 1990. But it takes a long time for the military to harden these things against nuclear warfare and EMP bursts and so forth. And those are the chips you want to buy. And even at that, if you're buying like a PowerPC chip that's about 32 megahertz in speed, if you can imagine even remembering that, they're $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 for one chip. Wow. So that's why these things are used, because they're hardened and they're affordable. So it's really, as you say, it's very basic AI, but it's enough that they can get out there and lead these machines and do their own jobs. And even to the point that most of them now, most of the orbiters and flyby missions that go out to the outer solar system, because they've got a fixed radio dish on them, they have to turn away from Earth to do their investigations using that dish and then turn back to Earth to transmit data back and forth, which sounds terrifying when you're that far out, but it works. And if it has a problem reacquiring contact with Earth, it just looks for the sun and it's like, okay, Earth is back that way, and now I know where to point. And then the communication starts anew. So that's what's happening now. I also write a series of books for Jet Propulsion Laboratory with the romantic title of Technical Highlights 2018, Technical Highlights 2019. Wow. Mm-hmm. I didn't name it. I just write it. But I get to sit down with 30 or 40 of the scientists there, the principal investigators working on the newest stuff. And a number of those stories have been about their AI efforts. And one of the most interesting ones was trying to figure out, when you're going to the moons around Saturn and Jupiter, and, you know, they're very far away. They've got to be able to operate on their own because of the many hours of radio signal delay, 6-7 hours. Even with the current technology, a lot of it's just about the software. The software is getting so good that they're really developing these programs that specialize in a couple of things. One is the spacecraft not just being able to sense its condition in terms of what's working, what's not, and temperatures and likelihood of failure and all that, but being able to predict what might go wrong and then how to, as they put it, fly through failure. So if something goes wrong, it can adjust and reprogram itself to continue the mission without intervention from Earth. And that, to me, is just spellbinding. You know, there's technology involved in that, everything from cell phone programming to video games. And those are some of the people they bring in to do this programming, and they're just brilliant. So I sit in those rooms talking to those guys, you know, feeling like a poodle in terms of intelligence, because they're just heat radiating off their head. They're so smart, and that's what's driving this program. The same thing's happening in other countries now. China and India, famously, are doing the same, and they're following very closely in our footsteps. In China's case, going one step beyond with the landing on the far side of the moon, which is something we contemplated but never actually pulled off.
Yeah. Didn't you write, by the way, that India's space probe, they were the only other nation that got it right the first time, right?
Yeah, and that was the MOM mission, the Mars Orbiting Mission, also called Mangalyaan, although I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that correctly. And they wanted to do, it's really an engineering mission, they wanted a proof of concept, but it was like $36 million. Wow. And our programs started about 10 times that price. And a lot of it's just the lower cost of labor. They have a huge percentage of women in the workforce on these programs because they tend to pay them less, so it's less expensive. And it's gotten to the point where JPL, I was having dinner with the chief engineer the other night, and he said, you know, it hasn't really hit the news yet, but we're going to start outsourcing some of our assembly and fabrication to India and then flying it in partnership with them because it's just so much less expensive. So you're seeing even the offshoring of space technology now, which, you know, there's one part of me that goes, oh, that's really smart. There's another part that goes, oh, USA, USA. But yeah. It's just globalization is the key to the future of this, I think. Privatization and globalization is what's going to carry the day, not just in human spaceflight, but in robotic, too. But the Indians, they got it right the first time. It was a big, weird kind of looping orbit. But they've done some really good science. And they've got another one planned very soon, and they've got a human spaceflight mission planned in a couple of years, which is going to be spectacular. So they nailed it after, when you look at something like Russia, who had tried dozens of times and got really close. But as you pointed out, they got landers there in 1971. They just didn't operate for more than a few minutes. But they got really close by just trying again and again and again with this very robust technology, but just haven't quite gotten it yet. They still haven't had a success at Mars.
Yeah, you point out something interesting too, though. I think Mars 2 and Mars 3 maybe were the ones that the Soviets put up there in the early 70s on Mars. They touched down, but they weren't described as being operative. You said they might have operated for a few minutes. I mean, was there at least a degree of functional operation when those probes actually made it to the Red Planet?
Well, they both had orbiters and landers, so the orbiters returned some good data. The landers made it to the surface. The first one crashed, so you can say it made it, but it didn't make it successfully. Mars 3 did touch down and sent back part of one television frame showing what we thought looked like part of the horizon, but it turned out it was just hash. So again, a momentary close miss, but it just didn't quite make it. And part of the problem they had with Soviet electronics back then, because we were still very siloed between us and the Soviet Union, so there wasn't any sharing going on, was that they were fairly primitive, and they were sequencers. So everything was set before the robot left Earth, and it was going to follow that procedure no matter what, to the extent that one of the orbiters arrived at Mars at the same time Mariner 9 did, the American orbiter. And on the Soviet side, they arrived at the planet, and it was just covered in one of these global dust storms, so it looked like a big orange billiard ball. But it did its thing because you couldn't intervene in the programming. So it went ahead and shot pictures of the planet for weeks, just staring down at the top of this dust storm, which, you know, it does give you some data on chemical composition and so forth, but it's not what you want. Whereas Mariner 9, because it was reprogrammable, JPL was able to send up command strings saying, okay, just park yourself for a few weeks, and then we'll take a look again when it clears up. So that was really one of the dividing lines, the bright lines between our program and theirs.
Yeah. You know, I'm a bit of a backyard astronomer myself. On any clear night in the summer months, especially when it's warm enough to be able to be outside, unlike the other night when we had that blood moon, you know, I think it was 13 degrees here, and I kept stepping out my back door to watch the eclipse. Did you get to see it?
I did. It was an interesting situation for me because I was on this webcast that Astronomers Without Borders and National Geographic were doing, which was really a lot of fun. So I was literally running back and forth from waiting for my interview to run outside and get a look and then run back in. And unfortunately, we got clouded out about halfway through. But it was just an amazing sight. I mean, all lunar eclipses are incredible. Solar eclipses are really incredible.
Oh, yeah.
And but that one was a very dark, ruddy red because the moon was so far inside the Earth's shadow that it was really just getting the very edge of the red light rays. So it was a spectacular sight. I'm sorry you missed it.
Yeah, well, it's fast. Actually, you know, I did get a chance to get out there despite the cold. I was able to watch it. It just wasn't comfortable. But now with the solar eclipse, there was the interesting, what they refer to as a sort of a ripple phenomena, which seems to be the air disturbance in the atmosphere that occurs during one of these eclipses. And NASA had put out to citizen scientists, hey, you guys be on the lookout for this. And we managed to film it, my group and I. And I was so excited about this.
No kidding.
Yeah. We actually filmed it. But come to find out there were dozens of other people who did a much better job filming it than I did. I was still excited about that, you know, because
well, there is some satisfaction in doing it yourself. Now, where did you see it from?
Okay, I was here in Asheville, North Carolina. It was horribly cloudy right over my house, and I thought I was going to miss the eclipse, and I had a few friends just a few miles away saying, hey, we've got full visibility here. We're in a big parking lot. Come join us. So I grabbed my camera. Couldn't take my telescope, but then again, you don't want to look at the sun through a telescope. That could be very dangerous. But we managed to get out there with proper filtering equipment and eye gear. And yeah, we got to see it and film it. And yeah, the ripple effect, which again, it looks almost like, you know, sand blowing across a desert during a storm or something. It was, you know, across the surface of the parking lot. It was clearly visible and we did manage to film it. But again, I wasn't the only one. I'm just fascinated that there's still, you know, aspects of our atmosphere and its relationship to things like eclipses that, you know, we're still trying to get, you know, information on. And NASA more and more seems to be outsourcing to citizen scientists. And like you said, with the globalization of space programs, they're reaching out and working in coordination with other countries, too. It's just a fascinating time to be alive. Hey, you know, I wanted to talk to you really quickly, too, because you mentioned Saturn and distant moons. There's also the hope that there may actually be life on some moons and, who, you know, for all we know, maybe even some planets elsewhere in our solar system. This brings us to the joint NASA and ESA spacecraft, Cassini-Huygens. You know, this was, again, one of these joint projects, an international collaboration, launched in 1997, reached its destination Saturn in 2004, and orbited, I think, until, was it last September that it completed its mission? Is that right?
Yeah, right. They went ahead and angled the spacecraft so it would go into Saturn's atmosphere, because the fear was that between the fact that it hadn't been sterilized for planetary contact, at least for anything like a rocky moon that had water that might contain life, and the plutonium on board was the fuel, was the power supply, it was thought that it was best to go ahead and let it do the suicide dive into Saturn. And the added benefit was those final orbits took it between the inner rings and the side of the planet as it was augering in closer and closer until it finally entered. And there's tons of good science that came from that. And I don't know if you saw the story just recently about the revised age of the planet's rings.
I did.
So there had always been this idea that, well, it was probably a failed moon or just some of that solar system junk that, that didn't manage to coalesce into something, or a moon that ran into something and exploded, was shattered. And that was what we thought for a long time. It was probably formed around the earliest part of the solar system. But once I got back this new data from the Cassini mission, they're able to gauge the purity of the ice and the rings at about 99%. So, and again, this is detective work. This just blows my mind. So yeah. Working back from that with mathematical models, they said, okay, knowing that, how long would it take that pure ice to become 1% impure? And it turns out the answer, and part of it's knowing the mass of that ring, it turns out the answer is about 10 to 100 million years. So they're much younger than we thought. They were forming somewhere around the time the dinosaurs went extinct. And the way they figured out the mass of that ring was, as a spacecraft passed between the rings and the planet, they were able to measure by the change in frequency of the radio signal by the probe being tugged slightly towards the innermost ring. They were able to measure the mass of those rings. And that just... I saw that and I thought, God bless these people. They are just remarkable. So that was a really cool story that came out of that.
Yeah, it's remarkable indeed. Yeah, I actually found a anecdotal report. This was from, I think, New Scientist back in 1991. But there was a scientist somewhere in Europe who had posited that he believed sometime in the last 2,800 years there may have actually been rings around Earth also. But Phil Plait over at the Bad Astronomy blog did a really interesting piece talking about, again, the fact that the composition of most of these ring systems around planets are largely formed of ice. Earth's proximity to the sun wouldn't allow for those rings to last as long, and hence why Earth doesn't have rings. I don't guess it's impossible that Earth may have had rings at some point, though. Have you ever looked into that?
I haven't, you know, and that I didn't actually see that paper, so that's really interesting deposit. And Phil Plait is just an incredible resource. You know,
oh, yeah.
He comes out swinging with his responses to these things, but it's always fascinating to read and listen to what he comes up with.
Yeah, he's really one of the best, in my opinion. We're talking with Rod Pyle, also one of the best, in my opinion, and his new book is Interplanetary.
Oh,
yeah, your new book is Interplanetary Robots, True Stories of Space Exploration. So I'm really looking forward to sharing more information with the listeners about this, and I definitely want to encourage them to read this book, because what we're talking about with Rod today, I'm sure it won't be the last time, but there's so much more that he details in this book. And again, something I told you before we got rolling here with the interview was that, you know, you bring a very personal touch to the coverage of the of these stories. And in addition to being an excellent communicator, I think that what I really like about your writing style, Rod, is that you present that human aspect that anybody can relate to. And it's not just the nitty-gritty technical details about space travel that, unfortunately, I guess, may be lost on the general readership. So, you know, again, I think people will really enjoy that human touch you put on these interplanetary robotic missions.
Well, I hope so. And there's a reason that that there's as many people in that story as there are. I had written about the same subjects previously in one way or another, because I write about JPL quite a bit. And it was pointed out to me in not so gentle terms by a few people close to me that, A, I had a pro-American bias and I needed to open that up. So I worked hard to do that in this most recent book. It's just one of those unobserved self-faults, you know. And the other was a couple of women, interestingly, said to me, you know, you don't have any people in these stories. And I said, well, they're about machines. They said, no, they're about the people that built them. And that's who we want to get to know. You know, we don't want to get to know some rover beyond a certain point. We want to know about the people that did it and their triumphs and shortcomings and so forth. And I thought, oh, yeah, that's a good point. And in particular, in the book Curiosity, which I wrote in 2014 about the Curiosity rover, I was gifted with being able to spend a lot of time with the chief scientist on that, a gentleman named John Grotzinger over at Caltech, which is about 4 blocks from where I was living at the time, so I could stroll over there any afternoon. And he was just a real blessing. I mean, he had so many great stories to tell, very engaging. Unfortunately, I'm not a grad student in geophysics, so I had trouble following a little bit of it. But it was just such a pleasure because, and he looked at me at one point and he said, you know, I get the feeling you're making me out to be the hero of this book, and I don't want that. I've got 500 scientists working for me. And I said, John, I understand that, but you have to understand that for those of us who love this stuff, you know, we may not have lives that are quite as engaging as yours. We're working a regular job, we're paying a mortgage, we're raising kids, we're paying off our cars and so forth. And to be able to spend some time just standing next to you, looking over your shoulder as you do these things, you know, it's not the same for us as it is for you. For you, it's your daily job. For us, it's an adventure. And he looked at me and kind of shrugged and said, okay, I guess so. So that's what I try to get across these guys, is you've been doing this for 10 years. You're soaked in it. It's your daily routine. But for us, it's a chance to really just enjoy this thrill of the moment of discovery when, you know, someday maybe you'll discover a dinosaur femur on Mars. And that would be an incredible moment to be standing there. So that's what I really hope to share.
Yeah, boy, that's, you know, the way you put that, that's just fascinating. It's like this is as close as we're going to get to real-life Star Trek. And I know you've contributed in various capacities to some science fiction and television programming over the years, too, so I'm sure that, you know, you often think about that. You're meeting people who are literally authoring the history of the future, and this is very much like what eventually, I guess, we watch on television in our science fiction. What we expect one day is that we will go to those other worlds, that we will go beyond the distance, that we will go where no man has gone before, right?
Well, you know, we keep hoping, and for people like me, I'm 62, I grew up during the hottest years of the space age. At that point, when you saw these missions going off the moon, you know, I was young, I didn't realize they were operating right at the bleeding edge of technology and they could fail at any moment. We kind of had that general notion, but not to the extent that I do now, having studied it for decades. And it just felt like, well, of course, you know, in another 10 years we'll be on Mars, and of course another 10 years beyond that, we'll be standing on the bridge of the Enterprise D with all that mauve corduroy upholstery they had and instant push button gravity, and it'll look like a cruise ship with phaser cannons and all that kind of thing. And it turns out that's a little harder to achieve than we thought. So we're still looking at really roughing it as we head out to the other planets once that finally starts to happen. So I'm crossing my fingers for you, Mr. Musk.
But
I mean, that's part of what drives us all, I think. And certainly as you talk to people within NASA, which is where I spent most of my time in terms of having access to space programs, you know, they were driven by, depending on the generation, Star Trek or Star Wars. And boy, if you want to get a good conversation going in the loudest possible terms, bring up which one's better and which one's sillier in the conversation at the cafeteria there, and you're going to get a lot of opinions about why Star Wars is the real thing and Star Trek is just a poser and vice versa. But that's the inspiration, and that's what we want ultimately.
Yeah, you know, really quickly, before we get into a little bit more of the nitty-gritty as it relates to the history of space probes and their functional purpose in terms of communicating back to us what's going on out there beyond Earth, our island home, I do want to mention, you know, I visited the London Science Museum with my dear friends Beth and Maria a few years ago, and they happened to have at that time a display which was open to the public, but you couldn't take pictures, and you'll know why in just a moment. It was called Cosmonauts, and they actually had some relics from the manned orbital laboratory and some of the Russian space program that, I mean, again, knowledge of this didn't come to light for several decades, but to actually see some of those, I mean, talk about cramped. These were manned capsules. I mean, these little spherical.
Yeah,
I'm sure you've seen some of this stuff. But I mean, again, so in your new book, part of what you are kind of emphasizing is the international aspect of this. And when I went to London and saw some of this, and again, they said you can't take pictures for two reasons. One, because some of this stuff is highly sensitive even to this day. And two, because we got a book full of pictures that we want to sell you when you get to the gift shop. But again, I was just fascinated with, I mean, the complexity, even going back to the 1970s, and the fact that they actually had, in various capacities for spy purposes, a functional space program.
Yeah, and then you get into looking at their attempt at the lunar landing program, which we knew we knew was going on, but we didn't know any of the details over here in the West back in the day. We just knew that there was a race afoot, and the Soviets kept saying, nah, we're not racing you to the moon. But at the same time, they were building their big N1 moon rocket, which tried to launch four times and failed due to engineering problems. But they had a lunar lander, and they had the Soyuz capsule, and they probably could have pulled it off with a single human on the moon. It only carried one, had they not had these problems with their booster. But you look at that hardware, and the hardware on both sides is primitive, but the Soviet hardware especially was really built to be basic and robust and foolproof, which is why, of course, Soyuz is still flying decades later. But it's, as you saw, it's kind of a sledgehammer approach to the problem, but it works. I mean, to the extent that for their unmanned program, the robotic program, most of the probes that went out to the other planets, to Venus and even to the moon and to Mars, their electronics were inside pressurized enclosures because they weren't hardened the way ours were. So rather than just flying them out in the cold vacuum of space like we did with these very robust systems, they just put it inside a miniature hull and filled it full of nitrogen gas and said, okay, that works. So if you've seen many of their unmanned machines, they're large, they're heavy, they had big rockets, that was not a problem. And they kind of look like something that's been taken over by a disease. You know, there's all these globules and round shapes and big, heavy structures. But they worked, and their success on Venus was just brilliant.
Yeah, it was just fascinating to see an entirely different approach. Because, again, at that time, due to the necessity, I mean, with the Cold War, you know, underway, I mean, there was a necessity for secrecy. And so we weren't sharing, well, I don't know, we were sharing some things. Because, I mean, even going back to the Kennedy administration, he was arguing for this joint U.S.-Soviet program at the time. So, I mean, there's always been that international aspect to it, and that's been part of the story. But nonetheless, there was what we shared, and then there is the aspect that was kept off the books. And so as we look back at some of their technology and how much it differs from what our guys down there in Alabama were working on, it's really fascinating. And speaking of, again, what we've, you know, done here in the U.S. over the years, I think it warrants mention that we talk about Viking, because really on a list of the top, you know, NASA and really in terms of programs that we've learned so much about space over time, in terms of the top 10, space.com did a write-up, and although, of course, they put the Apollo missions at number one, the first or the highest-ranking probe was Viking, and it really warrants some discussion here. I think it touched down on Mars in July of 76, if memory serves, and again, it's been one of the most probably lasting moments in the history. We've already touched on it a little, and you've mentioned it, but let's get into the significance of that mission and why it ranks so high on top 10 lists, you know, what that meant for space exploration and the U.S. Involvement in that at the time.
Viking was really just a triumph. You know, it was the logical extension of the Mars orbiting program, which had been based on the Mariner spacecraft going back to the first shot at Venus back in, I think it was 1962, Mariner 2. And so the orbital buses were based on Mariner. The Viking lander was a design that was based somewhat on the Surveyor lunar landers that had set down the moon in the mid-1960s to sort of reconnoiter that for the manned landings to come in a few years. But the likelihood of it working as well as it did was not high, right?
Yeah.
So that's why you launch twins. I mean, you launch two of each, two orbiters, two landers. And the fact that this planet, nothing had ever landed there, we had learned a lot about it from orbit, but there's only so much you can learn with that technology back then. So it was really this big jump into the unknown. And then you add to that this idea that they were so focused on life science. They really wanted to know, is there anything living there? Have we missed anything? Is this planet that looks like this absolute arid, frozen desert from orbit, is there a chance there's something down there? We didn't understand, of course, the soil chemistry yet, which is highly oxidized and full of perchlorate, not very friendly to living things, as near as we could tell. So these two landers went down. They had seismometers. They had weather instruments. They had great stereo cameras. But they also had these life science labs in them that, with 1960s technology, because this program was long in the making, of course, they had reduced a college classroom-sized life science lab down to something about the size of a large microwave. And they had figured out these small number of experiments that would do basic investigations. So the Vikings landed. They each had an arm and a scoop. Really ingenious arm design, by the way. Instead of the rigid folding robotic arms we have now, it was like a couple of tape measures welded along the edges that kind of spring metal. So it coiled, it rolled up onto a roller and then unrolled when it wanted to extend, but it worked very well. They'd go grab some soil and then dump it in these little funnels going to each of these experiments. Without going into too much detail, the basic idea was, look, let's get some dirt inside these canisters. We'll heat it. We'll add some nutrients, and we'll see if the bacteria respond to that by growing, if there's any bacteria there. Most of them didn't work. However, there was one that did show immediate and positive results, but they went up too high too quickly and then didn't repeat well. So the thought was that we were seeing a result of soil chemistry reacting to the water that was being injected, of course, because no rain falls on Mars, as opposed to seeing life grow. But there's still some controversy over that. As recently as the late 90s, There are groups doing experiments taking that same investigation package and using soil from the Atacama Desert down in South America, which is extremely sterile. And they looked at it and said, you know, given all the parameters and given what we're looking at, we think there might well have been a life indication, but we just won't know until we try something similar to that, more refined, obviously, but something similar to that in a future mission. And that's part of what the Mars 2020 rover is going to try and do. It's a real astrobiology mission.
Yeah, that's fascinating stuff. I even saw an article about that just a couple of years ago, if memory serves, that they were saying, you know, there was some interesting and some mixed results that we got, you know, from the early Viking mission. And, you know, some have you know, left that on the table as to what that may have meant, you know, whether in terms of astrobiology, geochemically, or whatever else about the Martian soil. It's fascinating stuff. Before we get into a little discussion about the new space race, I do want to point out, of course, not all of our attempts at studying the cosmos with robotics have been completely successful. You know, one chapter in your book, in chapter 29, you tell the story of the Galileo mission to Jupiter. It's a heck of a story. I don't know exactly what drew me to it. I just enjoyed the way you told that. It has to do with a particular substance that had been sitting around on a shelf for about a decade before it was used in a pivotal part of this mission. Can you tell us a little about that story?
So Galileo was originally supposed to fly in the shuttle in the 80s, but the Challenger accident, when the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up in 1986, waylaid that program for a number of years and slowed things down. So they had to take this already completed Galileo Jupiter orbiter, and this is a big machine. It's the size of it's larger than an automotive van. You know, it's a great, big, huge spacecraft, and store it. So it had trundled over to the East Coast to get ready for launch, and then when that was scrubbed, they drove it back to JPL, and of course, this is the government. So to save money, they just stuck it on a commercial trucking service instead of rail or a sea barge. And so it's crossing the country 3-4 times on the back of a flatbed truck. Well, the antenna for that spacecraft was a new design. Rather than most spacecraft antenna for these unmanned probes are rigid dishes. You want a nice, big, rigid dish. You can only make them as big around, obviously, as the fairing of the rocket, the size of the nose cone. Mm-hmm. So they wanted something a little bigger and more flexible, so they developed this thing that looked like an umbrella and worked much like an umbrella, and it worked very well in testing. And nobody realized that having that thing sit around for years and years and years, it didn't launch finally until the 90s, was going to be a problem. But turns out, as near as they could tell from the investigation, so just the core of this is, once that probe got up there, that antenna only opened partially and was virtually unusable. Mm-hmm. So they had to completely redesign how they went about everything using what they call a low-gain antenna, which is basically like a dial-up modem versus broadband like we have today. So it's really constrained in terms of the amount of data it can send. And the workarounds are brilliant, as elaborated on in that chapter.
Yeah.
But what turned out to be the problem was, as this probe was trucked back and forth coast to coast, the parts of the antenna that had to unfold, which were lubricated, were rubbing as they got bounced around. It rubbed off all that lubrication, and nobody ever thought to check it. This is one of those failures of imagination that they talked about with the Apollo 1 fire, where it was just something they didn't think about.
Right.
And it wasn't checked before launch, at least not in that detail. So when it went up there, it started to unfold, it hung up, and they tried thousands of times to get it to by jerking it back and forth and rotating it towards the sun, letting it heat up, and then rotating it in the cold, let it cool off, try these hot-cold cycles, or it would expand and contract and maybe move something. They tried everything, and it just would not open. So the workaround was, okay, we've got this trickle of data, so instead of something the size of a water pipe, we're operating through a soda straw now. Let's just figure out how to compress these images, get the most important ones, and then really use our data smarts to make it work. And again, because they had a reprogrammable computer, it was a very robust and flexible design with a certain amount of AI, they're able to get back, as you know, these incredible pictures of Jupiter
right.
and the moons around it. So it was just a real triumph of ingenuity.
That is one of the more fascinating aspects to me about space exploration. I mean, whether it's Apollo 13 and, wow, we've got a real problem. Houston, we've got a problem, as he famously said. And the workarounds right. that have to be on the spot. I mean, again, this is another highlight of the technical ingenuity and the honest genius that we see at work in our space program. I mean, this is one of the fascinating aspects of it. And that, of course, not a manned mission, fortunately, but nonetheless, one where they had to try and, you know, make the silk purse out of the sow's ear, and they still managed to do it. And look at some of the imagery that we got back from that program. It's just fascinating to me. Rod, it's come up several times over the course of this discussion already. You write about it both somewhat in this book and also in Space 2.0, one of your other fine contributions. And you know that you've really arrived, I think, when you can basically tell everybody, hey, you know, yeah, I've written some books and Buzz Aldrin wrote the foreword. You know, that's probably the surest sign that you have arrived. And of course, Buzz wrote the foreword for Space 2.0, but you often are talking these days, and you've actually been predicting, I've seen this for a long time from you, that there is going to be a new space race, but this one's going to be different. It's not going to be like what we've seen in the past, especially during the Cold War. We have had a lunar probe launched and landed on the moon by China, but then there's the private space programs that we're seeing. Jeff Bezos with Blue Origin and Elon Musk, as you mentioned, of course, with SpaceX. I mean, what are we looking at here in the next few decades? This has got to be an exciting time to be alive, but are you excited? Are you more apprehensive? What are your feelings about what we're seeing happen right now?
Well, I've been trying to characterize it. I mean, it's tempting to say new space race because of the entry of China and how aggressive they're being in their program. But I'm really looking at it as more of a new space age, which welcomes all comers and cooperation between government and private sector and governments all over the world, I hope. And that's something that Buzz is bullish on, is cooperating with China and India to take the best aspects of all those programs and combine them into one. But I think the turning point for me, and this is just my construct. This isn't anything, you know, that's been made official by anybody else.
Sure.
But I give a lot of talks to young people, and I was giving a talk to a group of aerospace engineer undergraduates and graduate students a few years ago. And I was waxing on about the Apollo program and what it was like to be alive then and seeing these missions take off every couple of months and men exploring the moon and, you know, primetime programming being interrupted so we could watch these moonwalks, at least till the public got bored. And I was going on and on about this, as I will do, as you can tell. And it was a very small group, and I saw some students down the front row crying. And I stopped, and I said, I'm sorry, was it something I said? And this young woman looked up at me through teary eyes and said, you have no idea how lucky you were to be alive then. We've seen nothing like that. And I just froze up for a second. I thought, my God, she's right. You know, that was a real gift. And at that time, this was probably 5 years ago, I said what I said to a lot of those groups, which is just hold on. You know, you're going to get out of school right when this kicks off again, and amazing things are going to be happening, and there's going to be opportunities for you guys like we never saw. In my day, if you didn't work for NASA or a defense contractor or university affiliated with them, you didn't have a job in space. Now it's everything from NASA and SpaceX and the United Launch Alliance and Boeing to university labs and people working in their garages, because this technology is so accessible now. But that was always a forward-looking statement. Then we saw the Falcon Heavy launch in early 2018, and this is Elon Musk's assembly of three Falcon 9 rockets. He thought it was going to be simple. It turned out to be a lot harder than that, so it took 5 years longer than he had predicted. But this was the first launch of this mega rocket, which is the step towards having the kind of launch capability we had with the Saturn V back in the 60s and 70s. And it worked the first time. And not only did it work the first time, as a guy who's gone to many shuttle launches and waited around for days and sometimes weeks for the things to take off because of the complications involved, this took off right on time. Yeah. And it worked just like you predicted, except for that third stage hitting the water, but everything else worked perfectly. I thought, we've arrived. We're here. It's happening finally now. And it's happening because some rich guy said, hey, I want to build rockets, NASA. And at first NASA said, yeah, that's a nice kid. Knock yourself out.
Right.
Well, now they're buying contracts from him to take stuff and soon people to the space station. So what a remarkable turnaround. And that's the tip of the iceberg. So as you mentioned, we've got him building and launching rockets and soon crewed capsules. We've got Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos's company, designing ever larger rockets and having success in flying his test flights. And soon he'll be sending people and masses of cargo up into suborbital and beyond orbit missions. And we've got companies like United Launch Alliance and Boeing who have said, okay, we see the shifts taking place. This isn't the same landscape we had in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s with defense buying, you know, single source rocket flights from us and so forth. We need to get aggressive. So they're developing expendables. They're developing their aerospace capsules. The contracts are completely different, saving money for government. They've gotten leaner and more aggressive. And it's just this wonderful new era for all of us. And the promise of what's available out there, once you start really using what's in the nearby solar system, you've got water ice on the moon, we think. We know there's water and other constituents, rare earth metals and so forth, in the asteroids that we can use. There's oxygen in lunar soil. So all these things, if you can go up and distill them, you can use them there. You don't have to spend $8,000 to launch a gallon of water anymore. You can just get it out there, and from that, you can get rocket fuel, breathable oxygen, drinkable water. There's metals. You can start manufacturing parts of rockets and spacecraft off-world. And this is the game change that we've been waiting for decades.
Wow, it's so exciting. You know, I almost want to quote Aldous Huxley, you know, Brave New World, but really, I guess since it's not just this world, it's more like Brave New Off-World. I mean, we're talking about a new era for space exploration. You do a fine job outlining how robotics plays into that with your book, Interplanetary Robots, True Stories of Space Exploration. Final thoughts here. Where do you see the future of space exploration, especially as robotics plays into this? Where do you see this going in the coming years, Rod?
Well, my lens for this has evolved recently. I've become editor of a magazine called Ad Astra for a group called the National Space Society.
And congratulations.
Their charter, thank you. And their charter, they're a large nonprofit, one of the largest of their kind, and their charter is human settlement of space. So as I've spent time editing that magazine, reading articles from the wonderful writers we get, and just continuing to do my own work, it becomes clear that there's this sweet spot that we're coming up on in the next matter of years to decade or two of, you know, how to appropriately use machines to go out and pioneer where we're going to go. Not only are they going to go look at distant worlds, but even within just the distance between the Earth and the Moon, there's things that machines do more safely and better than human beings. So we're going to use them increasingly to go to the Moon, prospect the soil, figure out what we can do with it, what's actually in it that we can use. I mean, we kind of know that already, but we'll learn more from the lunar poles and so forth, and how to better utilize these substances. And then you've got another sweet spot between government agencies like NASA and the foreign government agencies and private industry like SpaceX and Boeing and Northrop Grumman and Blue Origin ultimately, how to best use this combination in a creative way to get us as far as we can go, as quickly as we can do it, without breaking the bank. And the days of programs like Apollo are long gone. We're not going to have another Kennedy moment. That was a geopolitical thing anyway between the U.S. and the Soviet Union,
right,
more than it was science and exploration. But now there are other reasons to go out there. Yes, there's still great science to be done. There's places to be explored. But there's money to be made. And as we know, that's a great motivator for human beings. And it looks like the riches that we can pull down from space, both for use on Earth and there, are just immeasurable. I mean, just using solar power from orbit to send power down to Earth could displace a great part, if not all, of our reliance on fossil fuels within a decade if we really applied ourselves. And using these various substances I was talking about to build and fuel rockets and spacecraft to support people off Earth really is a game changer. So that's what I see happening. That's what I outlined in Space 2.0. My predictions will probably be proved vastly wrong, and I hope they are, and I hope they are proved wrong in short order. But that's what I see happening, and I have a really rosy outlook on the next 10 years because there's a lot of really smart people from many, many countries that heretofore didn't have an opportunity to participate in this discussion, this adventure, are coming into the mix. And these are brilliant people. They're everywhere.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, you are a brilliant fellow too, Rod, and I want to again give you kudos for an extraordinary book on this subject, and I'm sure that there will be many more. There already are plenty more, and do check them out at Pyle, PYLEbooks.com. Rod Pyle, author, journalist, and speaker, has been our guest. His book is Interplanetary Robots, True Stories of Space Exploration. Definitely check that out, and I'm sure it will be available in stores near you. And this won't be the last time we'll have Rod on the program, but that will be the final word for this week's edition. So thanks again, Mr. Pyle, and to all of you out there who continue to show support for and follow our work. And on behalf of all of us here at the Graylian Report, Chris Hayes, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Jeremy London, Rayson Robin Hobbs, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Jason Pintrail, James Waldo, Tiffany Mack, the lovely assistant Lauren, the Graylian Reverend Matthew Oakley, and I am Micah Hanks, yours truly. We'll catch you guys again next time here on the Graylian Report. And as always, stay strange out there.